What we could see is that only after 2 weeks of treatment, always talking in the animal model, we saw a very drastic tumor growth reduction.
Hi, I'm Alex, and welcome to the X-Health Show, where I talk to visionaries behind the latest innovations in healthcare for the extra health of the future. We're meeting today at this Zurich Translational Center, sitting between the University of Zurich and ETH Zurich, Switzerland. My guest today is Dr. Anna Montalban-Arkes, the CEO of Free Colony. Trained in molecular biology and biotechnology, she researched host-microbe interactions in the gut, which resulted in founding Free Colony. It's a Swiss startup, a spin-off from the University of Zurich. They aim to develop a bacteria-based oral therapy to treat and prevent colorectal cancer. No chemotherapy, no side effects, oral administration at home. You'll hear about gut microbiome and its influence on colorectal cancer, studies of specific strains of bacteria that show reducing tumors in mice. Please note the treatment is not yet available, even in clinical trials, so not available for patients at this time. Anna, we're not speaking probiotics, are we?
We are not speaking probiotics, and normally I get this question because there is a lot of similarities. We are talking about bacteria. We are talking about commensal bacteria, bacteria that are good for us. But there is a difference between probiotics and live biotherapeutic products. And these rely basically on the regulatory situation. So a live biotherapeutic product is defined as a bacteria, for example, that can treat, cure, prevent, or ameliorate a disease. We are talking about a disease claim. Whereas when we talk about probiotics, they are used in the healthy population. So if you want to use a bacteria in a disease population, it's considered a drug. It cannot be considered a probiotic anymore.
But the foam is the same, isn't it?
It's a bacteria. So when we talk about just the bug itself, it can be the same. But depending if you use it in the healthy or in the disease population, you have to follow different paths, right, different regulatory paths, and then they can be called and be treated as a probiotic or not.
Okay, clear. When did you realize that bacteria may be used as the treatment instead of current colorectal cancer treatments?
So this was basically my postdoc project that I initiated at the University of Zurich and at the University Hospital here in Zurich in 2018. And we saw actually in animal models. It was very curious because we were working with colitis-associated colorectal cancer models. And this is animal models where you first induce inflammation, and due to the inflammation and specific spontaneous mutations, then these animals develop the tumors in the colon. And the thing is that it was very hard for us to induce tumors in those animals. When compared to other groups doing the same method, others could have a lot of tumors in these animals in the colon, and we barely had some. Hmm. So we went one step back and said, okay, let's analyze the feces of these animals to study the microbiome and see what is different in animals from different facilities. And we found out specific bacteria there that might be the responsible of this effect. And this was exactly, we found a negative correlation between the amount of tumors and the amount or the abundance of butyrate-producing bacteria in general as a whole. And then that was the initial step, and we started studying what's going on with these butyrate-producing bacteria in the context of colorectal cancer.
Okay, we'll come back to that. But first, why did you study colorectal cancer?
Why did I study it? Well, since I started in research, I was always interested in host-microbial relationships. So this is something that you start studying something just maybe by chance, or just starting a research group and they say, okay, this is the project we have for you. So when I started doing my master in molecular biology and biotechnology, I was given this project where I was using zebrafish to study inflammatory bowel disease. And this in this project, I had to find also the differences, related to the microbiota? What are the differences when these animals have or not have microbiota in the gut?
In zebrafish.
In zebrafish.
Okay. What do they look like?
They are very small. So I was using larvae, 6 days larvae. So from zero, from the egg stage until 6 days. So these are very tiny larvae that are transparent.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the beauty of it, because you can have transgenic models and you can see the immune cells staying in different colors. So when you are under the microscope, you can see some cells moving from one place to the other, doing the job, healing a wound. And you see those cells going to the place and returning in green or in red. And you can distinguish which cell is doing what.
So this is why zebrafish, they pop up in research like from time to time, because you can see through the lava, basically.
Exactly.
Oh, okay.
And the funny thing also is that in the case of the gut, their gut structure is very similar to the human one.
Oh.
So that's why it's a suitable model to study gut-related diseases.
Okay. And from this study, colorectal cancer was something next?
What was next? When I finished the master, I was so interested in this host-microbial relationship, how bacteria can actually influence our health and our disease, how bacteria can impact the immune system, that I was looking for a PhD project related to this topic. And that's why I went to Austria, to Graz. And there I was studying a project in lymphocytic gastritis, actually. So it's another disease in the stomach, and we found also certain correlations with certain specific bacteria. And after that, so I was always within the gastrointestinal tract, a bit more up, a bit more down. During my postdoc, I went back to inflammatory bowel disease, also studying microbial peptides. And it was only when I came here to Switzerland when I started with colorectal cancer. So before I was studying inflammatory diseases, inflammatory bowel disease, lymphocytic gastritis, a bit of celiac disease, H. pylori gastritis. And just in 2018, I started with colorectal cancer, okay, but always looking at the impact that the microbiota has.
Yeah, what are the characteristics of the colorectal cancer?
So colorectal cancer is a type of cancer that occurs anywhere along the colon or in the rectum. And it's a cancer that evolves very slowly. So from the moment you have like a polyp that can have also different nature. So the polyp can have adenomatose characteristics or hyperplastic. If it's hyperplastic, it's benign. So it won't lead to cancer. But the adenomatose one can lead to cancer. So it starts with a polyp and it grows very slowly, and every time it can go more in deep in the colon wall, that it was make it dangerous.
Right, and this is why colonoscopy is such an important diagnostics, right? Because
exactly. If
you remove polyps at the right moment, you may actually prevent growing them into a tumor.
That's the best prevention, exactly, to have the colonoscopies.
One thing, just guys, if you're listening to us, we're not medical doctors, so please do not consider anything we say as medical advice. Please consult a medical doctor if you have any concerns. Okay, well, preparing to it, I also read that there is something called dysbiotic gut microbiota that has kind of influence. You touched on it a bit, right? Could you tell a bit more about that?
Yes, dysbiosis means disbalance. So our gut microbiota, it's normally in the healthy situation, balance between, you know, commensal pathogenic like bacteria. The problem is when something happens in the gut, for example, when we are being treated with antibiotics, this might cause an imbalance. And when that imbalance happens, that can trigger bad bacteria to increase in abundance and the good ones to decrease. When this imbalance happens is when inflammation might occur, and inflammation might lead ultimately also to, for example, colorectal cancer eventually in the long term, right? or to inflammatory bowel disease, or to IBS, so inflammatory bowel syndrome. So it's just a disruption in the normal balance of the microbiota.
Well, I just want to ask, like, about the number, like, how many bacteria do we have in the gut, or how many, I don't know, families, like any number, or like the healthy gut, right? Mm-hmm. And how much it can go down, or what's the worrying, or do we even know that?
So when talking about different species in the gut, we can have around 1,000 different species. But the important thing here is not only how many different ones, which is very important to have a microbiota that it's rich in terms of species number, but we have like trillions of bacteria in the gut. And when you think about how much this bacteria actually is, we can say that these bacteria are about 2 kilograms of your body weight.
Oh, wow. That's quite a lot.
That's quite a lot of bacteria.
Probably. I'm just thinking losing weight. Well, losing the bacteria is not the way we want to go, right?
Don't worry about those 2 extra kilograms. It's just your gut microbiota.
Okay. And are they different? I mean, we already had like a few times people speaking about microbiota. So I can imagine there are a bit different bacteria in different parts of the gastrointestinal tract.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
Okay. How they differ? Is it the number that differs? Is it like the species, the role they have?
It's actually all of them. Hmm. So from going from the stomach to the colon, there is an increase in bacteria. This is mostly based on the pH.
Uh-huh.
So the pH in the stomach is very low, it's 1 to 2. So there are less bacteria that survive that kind of environment. And it goes up from, you know, few hundred bacteria that we can have in the stomach to these trillions that we have in the colon.
Oh, wow.
This is based, as I said, on the pH, but also on the roles that the bacteria can play in one or the other place. So in the small intestine, we have more digestive function. So there is a lot of absorption of nutrients there. But in the colon, the bacteria, it's very important for the digestion of nutrients that we cannot digest.
Hmm.
For example, fiber. We don't have the right enzymes to absorb fiber, but the bacteria do. So that's very important for our own metabolism. And this is one of the functions, of course, the digestion, the nutrition. And the other is to keep our immune system in shape.
Okay, but these are called commensal bacteria. I can imagine they also get something out of it, or they don't. Like, going back to the meaning of commensal.
Mm-hmm. Of course. So they also choose where to live based on which kind of environment we provide to them. So if the bacteria likes more to have a basic pH, they will go more down to the colon. Or if they like to be more exposed to the lumen, which is like the empty space in the gut, or they like more to be close to the mucus layer. So we have the lining of the colon, some mucus layer, and has 2 different layers. So one that is more dense, and the one that is close to the lumen is less dense, but there are a lot of nutrients there, and there are a lot of bacteria that are, you know, being fed by those nutrients.
Well, this is actually one of the questions I had, like are they floating around there, or are do they have like their you know, favorite places?
They do have favorite places. Yeah. They can be more exposed to this lumen or be more close to the mucus.
Mm-hmm.
This is a matter of their taste.
Awesome. Okay, so let's go back to the colorectal cancer. And what's the... Oh, no, maybe let me first go back to this dysbiotic gut microbiota. What does it look like in colorectal cancer?
So this is one of the first things we actually saw when we check the situation in humans regarding this bacteria and other bacteria in colorectal cancer. What we saw, and this is something we saw across different population within different geographical regions. I mean, we were studying healthy and diseased population, meaning colorectal cancer patients in the US, Austria, Germany, France, China.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And this was very similar signature in all of them. There were specific bacterial species that were less represented.
In all of these continents?
Exactly. In the colorectal cancer patient, we have some bacteria that were downregulated. Sometimes they were even absent compared with the healthy population. And these bacteria were actually the same one, belonging to the same family as the one we detected in the mice. So that's why we had this hypothesis. We asked ourselves, okay, could we give back to these patients the bacteria they are lacking in order to treat or even prevent the development of colorectal cancer? That was our initial point.
What was the moment when you realized that it's actually the same bacteria that you already saw missing in mice?
So that was actually very positive for us to see that what we saw in mice was also the situation in human. Of course, when you go down to a species level, a strain level, there are differences, but the basics, the families were the same ones. So we thought this cannot be by chance. So this just make you go further and further and investigate why those bacteria, what do these bacteria have in common and why they are so special or so important, and whether they could have this potential to be a treatment.
So I can imagine you were collaborating with hospitals or like any medical institutions on these continents.
So these were metagenomics analyses that were performed in collaboration with another research group. And these studies were publicly available. So once each of the studies were, done in different countries at different time points, but once they are published, they are also published to, for the whole public to use. Maybe they just use it for different purposes, but since there are a lot of information out there, some other people can use that specific study to study something else.
Okay, so what I'm hearing, it was not your study, but this was some research that actually made sense for you.
Exactly, and what we did was to put all of those together and study what we want to see here. Let's see, what is the situation in colorectal cancer patients? Normally, people were studying, where are the bad bacteria? Where are the bacteria that all colorectal cancer patients have in common?
Mm-hmm.
And it's known that, for example, Fusobacterium nucleatum is a pathogen-like bacteria for colorectal cancer. But we wanted to see it from the other side. Where are the good bacteria that these patients don't have?
Okay, wow. Okay, but now, what's the current gold standard for treatment of colorectal cancer?
Mm-hmm.
We're not speaking bacteria, or are we speaking a bit?
Not yet. So the standard of care for colorectal cancer is surgery in early stages. So in early stages, the tumor is very localized, so it's very easy to remove. Sometimes the patient might need or not adjuvant therapy to be sure that everything is cleaned out. The problem comes in late stages. So in late stages, patients rely in chemotherapy and radiotherapy also as adjuvant normally, specifically in the case of rectal cancer, which is very difficult to treat, they rely more on radiotherapy. But let's say that the standard of care in late stages of colorectal cancer is still chemotherapy.
Oh, what's the life expectancy for colorectal cancer?
We'll be right back. This episode is brought to you by The X-Health Show and me, Alex. If you still haven't, please hit follow at the top. That'll help me bring more of these visionaries to you. Thanks a lot. Stay awesome now. Back to the episode.
So in early stages, it's very high. So we are talking from 75% to 90%. The problem is in late stages of colorectal cancer. In stage 4, meaning the metastatic stage, it's around 14-15%.
Okay, wow.
It's very low.
And actually, whatever, you can't really, or you don't have symptoms. You might not have symptoms until these late stages, right? That's why, again, colonoscopy is such an important diagnostics.
Exactly. Sometimes mm-hmm. when the patients are diagnosed, it's already late in the sense that the tumor is quite advanced.
Mm-hmm. So what are the challenges with this treatment?
So there are different challenges. So one of the challenges with colorectal cancer is their recurrence. So even when the tumors are resected, they might come back.
Hmm.
And if that happens, that happens in around 50% of patients. When that happens, the tumor, it's normally more aggressive. The other challenge is if the patients relied on chemotherapy, most of the people know how that is in terms of side effects. And you are dealing with hair loss, nausea, fatigue, infertility. It's really not the best solution. That's why we want to provide the patients with something new. And then, of course, in late stages, in the metastatic stage, the tumors are difficult to treat, and the life expectancy, as we said, is very low.
Mm-hmm. Just one thing. I mean, at the moment, these are the life-saving or can be life-saving therapies, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I just wanted to say that because there is no alternative now. What you work on, or this is also, guys, for you to hear. So we're speaking basically the treatment that is not yet available even in clinical trials. So we'll speak a bit later about like when your solution you plan to be available for patients, but now it's still in the research phase, preclinical basically, mm-hmm. right?
So
not for humans, not for patients yet. Yeah, what then is the bacteria that you discovered? What's the family, or what is the characteristics of that mm-hmm. bacteria that you discovered that is missing in patients with colorectal cancer?
So the bacteria normally have very fancy names that are not saying much, just about a bit, the classification and the features that they share. So we are talking about Clostridialis bacteria when talking about the order of the bacteria. They have one thing in common, that they produce butyrate, but actually the butyrate is not what it's playing the role in this case. It was a recurrent question we had, and actually we had a look at it, but the butyrate was not a metabolite that had the anti-tumor effect. It's just something that they have in common and something that it's part of their metabolism. These are anaerobic bacteria, so they are not that easy to handle. You have to handle that in specific conditions. We have an anaerobic chamber where we have this anaerobic atmosphere, and the bacteria can grow there. And
what was there in this atmosphere? How do you create it, basically? That's the question.
So we have like a closed chamber where our researchers are putting the hands in through these gloves. This is an image that everyone has seen in the in the news and so on. And there is a mix of gas that it's a mix with different percentage of different gases that make, this anaerobic atmosphere, just to have as little oxygen as possible, like close to zero. Because the bacteria is very, very sensitive to oxygen. So if they are exposed to oxygen, let's say for an hour, they will die.
Oh, well, okay. Okay, so they are anaerobic. When were they actually discovered, or do you know that?
Discovered as such. These data I don't have in mind, but I think at least one of them around the 70s was discovered, in the sense that it was isolated and then it was characterized. Say, okay, now we have this bacteria that was not defined before.
Mm-hmm. Do we know like what was the percentage of the human bacteria they represent?
Yes. So in the gut, one of the strains we are working with, it represents about 5% of the overall gut microbiota.
Okay.
And the other one around 1%. And we know that 99.9% of the healthy population have this bacteria. That's why we are also certain that the bacteria are safe.
Uh-huh. And what is, do we know? Because like, what do we know about their role, or like how they will behave, or their role in protecting us against the colorectal cancer? Do we know that?
So this is something that is always difficult to study, and it's also a recurrent question. Is this the cause or the consequence?
Right.
Of the microbiome.
And I know also like the bacteria field is something new, and you know, researchers work on it. So we still have more questions than answers, right?
Exactly. It's a very complicated system because you can understand it as that any other ecosystem. If you think about the ocean or you think about a forest, it's a very complicated environment where there are a lot of different players having their own roles and everything is interconnected. So yes, isolating one of these players and, you know, knowing exactly what this is doing and how is the connection with the rest of players is a very complicated topic. So we know through our research what these bacteria are doing. So we have, for example, deciphered the mechanism of action of these bacteria in inducing the immune system and eventually attacking the tumor cells. But there are a lot of unknowns as well.
So let's start maybe with the unknowns and then like what can you say about that, what we know?
So unknowns, for example, how these bacteria interact with other bacteria. So this is a very complicated question. So we know that in our gut microbiota, the bacteria are interacting with each other. They can even share genes or they can have co-nutrition between one and the other. They have the benefit from the metabolism of the other. So it's known that this kind of interaction happen, but to understand all of them, it's very difficult.
Yeah, if we have trillions, I mean, there's a lot. So what do we know? You said you discovered the mechanism of action. Like, what can you tell about that?
So when doing our research, we took these specific bacterial strains of interest. We were giving them orally to mice that were induced with tumors. And once the tumor were visible, we started to treat them with the bacteria. What we could see is that only after 2 weeks of treatment, always talking in the animal model, we saw a very drastic tumor growth reduction when compared to the controls. So this was something very, you know, positive for us, also very surprising that it worked even when the bacteria was not in direct contact with the tumor. So, And that's why we were wondering, okay, how is this bacteria actually working? In some of the models, we have the bacteria in the gut because we give it orally, but the tumors were induced subcutaneously.
So under the skin, right?
Under the skin, exactly. So what we did was to analyze the serum compartment within the blood. And there we found out constantly, very specifically, one metabolite that was increased in those animals that were previously treated with bacteria. And later on, we found out that that metabolite has the anti-tumor capacity. Now we know that that metabolite is the agonist of a specific receptor that is present in macrophages. So when that metabolite is targeting that receptor, what we see is that a specific cytokine, so IL-12 it's called, it's increased locally in this tumor microenvironment. And this cytokine is in charge of attracting the cytotoxic T cells to the tumor. And these cells are eventually the ones in charge of killing the tumoral cells.
So the killer T cells, we had them also on the show. Yeah,
exactly.
How did that affect mice?
So when we treat the mice orally with this bacteria, what we see is this tumor reduction. So in the size. And when we analyze the tumors, what we saw is that cold tumors were turning hot. That means that what it makes difficult for the tumors to be treated is that the immune cells don't see the tumor. They remain in the periphery of the tumor. When we were treating the mice with this bacteria, what we achieved is that the immune cells were infiltrating the tumor. Only when the immune cells infiltrate the tumor, they are able of killing the tumoral cells. That's what we saw when we were analyzing the tumors of these mice.
Okay, and this metabolite, is it the molecule that you work on now?
So based on that metabolite and also on the receptor, we have identified now as a second project, we are developing a small molecule that will be targeting the same receptor. We want to find out what is the best target for that receptor to have this anti-tumor capacity. And we can also control the dose of this small molecule because this is something you cannot do with the bacteria.
That's interesting. I also read that 7 different animal models responded to your bacterial therapy. Could you tell a bit more about these seven different models? And again, guys, I mean, we're speaking animals, right? And preclinical, we cannot translate it into humans, right? So we still don't know how would that work in humans. But what's happening already in mice is real, real interesting, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So we tested it in seven different animal models. So all of them in mice, because you cannot just say, okay, my therapy is working when you just have positive results in one model. This is an artificial kind of system in the end. So the first model we used was this colitis-associated colorectal cancer model I mentioned. In this one, we needed, before having tumors, we needed inflammation. And that was one of the questions. So the question was, okay, maybe you don't have tumors when you treat the animals with this bacteria, because the bacteria, what they are avoiding is the inflammation in first place. So if there is no inflammation, there is no tumor. Mm. Okay, fair enough. So then we went to a model that was independent of inflammation. That was an orthotopic model in colorectal cancer.
Oh my God, guys, we're so grateful to all these mice that work for science. Thank you, mice.
Yes. This model also works, but it's a very complicated model. You need someone that really knows how to perform these surgeries. And then we went to the heterotopic model, the subcutaneous one. And this is by far the best, also for not only for the mice, it's also more mild for the mice, but also for us to measure along the experiment the tumor, how the tumor is progressing. Because since it's under the skin, you can measure it like daily.
But if it's under the skin, is it still colorectal?
You can inject any kind of tumoral cells under the skin.
Mm.
So we did it with colorectal cancer cells, but we also did it with melanoma cells, breast cancer cells, and lung cells. Those are all the models we are talking about.
And they all responded to the bacteria?
All responded to the bacteria.
Oh.
And we also tested it in different lines of mice. So the mice have a genetic background. And normally in research, there are two mostly that are being used. So we wanted to be sure that this effect is not associated just with one genetic background. So we tested an additional type of mice, so two different strains of mice, to be sure that it was not dependent on the genetic background.
Now you work on two products. So one is this small molecule that you already mentioned that is in early development stage. And the other is?
So the first and most advanced is the live biotherapeutic product, which is in preclinical stage. We are now starting to work with the drug substance. So with these freeze-dried bacteria that we will eventually encapsulate in gastro-resistant capsules to give it orally to the patients. We are already working on that, and we are testing the safety and the efficacy in our animal models. With this one, we expect to reach the clinic by the end of next year. And the second project, which is in discovery phase, is the small molecule project that is based on the discovery of the mechanism of action. So both projects are very interconnected in the end.
What timeline are we speaking? One and the other.
We'll be right back. I want to say thank you for listening to this episode. If you find it interesting and feel particularly generous today, leave a review, hit this star rating. I'll be able to continue with the X-Health show for you. 3, 2, 1, and back to the episode.
So they are more or less like 2 years apart from each other. So as we plan to reach the clinic with the live biotherapeutic product in 2025, with the small molecule, we plan to do it 2 years later, in about 2027. So by the end of this year, what we plan to have is a lead compound to go into the preclinical phase next year.
2025?
Yeah.
Hmm. Okay, and this live biotherapeutic product, how would it work?
So this consists on two commensal bacterial strains that, as I said, are freeze-dried and encapsulated. We will give it orally to the patients, and these capsules will release the content in the colon. So once the bacteria are released in the colon, they get hydrated again and they start to grow and, you know, reproduce as normally they do in the gut.
It's so much different than, you know, the current cancer treatments, isn't it?
Yeah, we play with the fact that we are giving a oral therapy, which is normally not the case. So the patients can take the therapy at home. They don't need for these recurrent visits to the hospitals. It's a therapy that we expect to be much safer and have a much better tolerability. And we really expect, so we really hope we have efficacy in patients, and we can make this a reality, of course.
Did you see any side effects in mice?
We haven't seen any side effects so far, but since we have really to be sure that this cannot happen, there are certain experiments that we have to do during the preclinical phase that are also asked by the regulatory authorities. Because in colorectal cancer patients, we can have patients that are immunocompromised, that they have dysbiosis, as we have been talking before, or that they even have a leaky gut. That means that the wall of the gut is not that strong. So potentially it can happen that some bacteria translocate outside of the gut. To be sure that our bacteria is not doing any harm in any of those situations, we have to do what it's called biodistribution studies. And for that, we have to work with mice that are immunocompromised, that have dysbiosis. This we induce by treating them with antibiotics, or that have a leaky gut. And for that, we have to treat them also with a certain chemical that is producing this inflammation and it's mimicking this situation. So in all these cases, when we give our bacteria, we have to be sure that our bacteria won't be found in another organ. This is something, the thing that the regulatory authorities are worried the most. They are not that worried about the safe as such, because as I said, all of us have this bacteria. But what can happen if the gut is not strong enough, or if the immune system is not in shape? Could this bacteria in that case do something bad to the patient? That's what we have to show.
Are there any other challenges that you'll be facing now?
So the fact of producing the bacteria at large scale is a challenge, because for that you need to work with a specialized company that it's specialized, meaning that they know how to handle anaerobic bacteria, and they have the fermenters to grow the bacteria at big scale, and then they do this freeze-drying process. During all this process, the viability of the bacteria can be compromised because they are subjected to a lot of stress. And this is also something that is particular to each kind of strain. Some strains can grow super fast in the fermenter, and some of them might not be so happy, especially when the fermenters are big.
Do you know which group belong your bacteria to?
So we now have the first pilot batch of the drug substance, and our bacteria has performed well. So we are happy with that.
And they're happy bacteria.
Happy bacteria. Of course, the fermentation we have received now was performed in a 5-liter fermenter. This is rather small, but it's enough to start doing our preclinical safety and efficacy studies. But now the next step is to put them in bigger tanks, in 150 liters tank, and it can go up to 3,000 liters. Because you really need a lot of material to have enough capsules to run a clinical trial.
So this is what already exists, right? These 150 liters chambers?
This is something that is currently in progress. So the 5 liters material we have already, we have received several grams to start working with this. Now it will go to the 150 liters, and in a few weeks we will know how the bacteria is performing there.
Okay. Are there any like additional certificates needed for this, or for the production, I mean? Or is this something like a completely new route, because this is going to be a drug and not the probiotic?
So this production at the moment is happening, you know, under non-GMP conditions, but when we go into the bigger fermenters, we will go into GMP. That's make it suitable to go into into clinical trials for, you know, it's a product that will be suitable for patients. At the moment, it's just for research.
And then you said that you plan to start your clinical studies, so the studies in humans next year, like the second half of the next year. Who will you collaborate? I mean, do you already have partners, or do you already, well, basically have what it takes to start these studies? Or like, what do you need maybe? Because it's, yeah, obviously it's the still time. What do you need to make it happen?
This is something we are currently discussing. We are having conversations with different oncologists to set what is the best way of designing the clinical trial, in which hospital should we do it, because most probably it won't be enough just doing it in here in Zurich. We will need some other collaborators. The idea is to stay local in Switzerland, because we have talked with Swissmedic, and for the phase two, when we need, you know, more patients and more hospitals, then we might go to the rest of Europe or even to the US. But for the moment, we will stay here in Switzerland, and probably we will work with different hospitals. But this is ongoing discussions we are having.
You mentioned Swissmedic. Like, what were their reactions when you come over and you say, well, we have the bacteria that might work for colorectal cancer, and we want to treat them, no side effects?
So Swissmedic was very open to hear our proposal, and they were very positive when we presented. We have this scientific advice meeting with them. They were not scared at all. I mean, they are open for this kind of approaches, and they were also willing to implement this in Switzerland. So they were very looking forward to have an approach like this in the clinics here in the country.
I'm also asking because there are studies that say basically that if you have the drug, or if you give a drug to a patient and this drug is, for example, well, I don't know, pineapple taste, or like taste well, basically, you know, patients do not really think it's going to cure them. Because it tastes well, you know. And again, like if you have, like I'm thinking, you know, this live biotherapeutic and no side effects, they are actually, well, now it's connected with cancer therapies, you know. It may feel strange. Does it work? Like, how would you be able to tell if it works or not? In mice, it's a bit accelerated, right? How the reaction works. In humans, it might be different.
So what we need first in humans in the clinical trial is to show that it's safe in patients. That's first of all. And then in this safety study, we can also check already some preliminary efficacy data. So we can check in the patients whether the microbiome has shifted or whether the immune system is responding, or how is the metabolomics profile in the blood of those patients if we have more of this metabolite we were talking before. So those are the kind of signals we need to see. And then if the safety goes well and we have some signal, then we will be able of running a second study to show and to focus on the efficacy of the treatment.
Okay, we're not yet speaking about any doses, right? It's too early.
So the particularity of live biotherapeutic products is that they don't respond to a normal dose response curve. Hmm. So normally when you give a drug, you will have the more concentration of that drug you give, or more frequent, the more response you will have. But in bacteria, it's not working like that, because if you give, for example, an overdose of bacteria, the most probably the bacteria will just go out. They will just leave your body. So it's difficult to induce an overdose of bacteria, let's say. So this is also that makes something different when it's when we are talking about designing the clinical trial. What other people working with live biotherapeutic products are doing is to dose the highest concentration of bacteria they can get during the production. They will dose that to the patient on a daily basis, for example, or twice a day during a certain period of time that typically for cancer will be around 4 to 6 weeks. And with that single dose, you will see if it's working or not. But we cannot test like different doses because it's just not the way it works in this case.
So it's not like if you take probiotics, I mean, yeah, I'm still comparing a bit. You take like a daily doses and like for, say, 3 weeks and then not. You're speaking about one, really.
So the idea, so this is also something that is under discussion, but just looking at other clinical trials with live therapeutic product, they are dosing every day during 4 to 6 weeks, more or less, to treat the tumors and to see certain efficacy signal.
Now, if everything goes well and patients, you know, you'll get patients responding, when this live biotherapeutics can be available for patients, so basically when they could be on the market.
So for all type of drug development, this is always a long path because you have to run all the clinical trials. It takes a lot of time. You also have to do fundraising in between and so on. So we were calculating more or less that by 2030, approximately, this live biotherapeutic product could reach the market.
And what do you need to make it happen? You mentioned fundraising. Are you fundraising now?
We are fundraising, of course, but it's about that, but also how long it takes to run each of the clinical trials. For a safety trial, you might need 1 year to recruit the patient, treat the patients, and do the follow-up visits. Then to recruit patients for a second clinical trial, for a phase two, where you need more patients, it will take probably more time to recruit them, and maybe the clinical trial, it's just longer and you just need to wait for the results. And before going in a phase three, you need to gather all those results, put them together. Or by phase three, which is a huge clinical trial, you might need to partner with a pharma company, or maybe we have an exit by then. So it just takes time.
Okay. And you are now in the pre-seed phase, or you'll be now fundraising for Series A?
We will fundraising for Series A.
Okay. Yeah. So just the next step. So I have like two more questions, like the next step for Recolony and the bigger picture, basically, for bacterial treatments. Like, how do you see it?
So the next steps for Recolony, this is something that we are currently working on, is exactly that, to show the safety and efficacy with our drug substance. If we keep the efficacy with the drug substance as we had it before with the actively growing bacteria, then we can go on with the production of the drug product, meaning the drug substance encapsulated. This is like the next big milestone.
You mentioned there was the response in mice in breast and melanoma cancers when you used your live biotherapeutics. Are you going to follow up on it?
Absolutely. So it's true that we saw efficacy, preclinical efficacy in different solid tumor models, so melanoma, breast cancer, and lung cancer. And this is also something we are currently discussing with the oncologists, whether it would be good even for the safety study already to include different kind of patients with different solid tumors, or we could leave it then for the efficacy studies, because it's true that specifically in melanoma and lung cancer patients, the tumors are more immunogenic. So that means that they are a bit easier to be treated with immunotherapies, and our live biotherapeutic product is considered an immunotherapy. So it's of course worth to try it and include this kind of patients also in the clinical trials.
Well, so this opens up like a completely also different world, and like, where can we go with these live biotherapeutics?
And then the overall big picture. So we can see already that there are live biotherapeutic products reaching the market. This was something that until 2022 we didn't have. Now there are three live biotherapeutic products that have been approved for a different indication, for Clostridium difficile infection. And this is just because the research of the microbiome and host microbial relationship started more or less with this disease. And those are the ones that are now reaching the market. So the next wave will be the ones that are being used to treat inflammatory conditions. such as inflammatory bowel disease and so on. And the third wave will be the cancer ones, the ones that are being used to treat cancer. And then there is a fourth wave that are the life biotherapeutic products that are being used to treat certain mental conditions, such as depression, autism, because it has been seen that there is a gut-brain axis and the bacteria in the gut can actually influence a lot what's going on in the brain.
No, this is fascinating, really. But do you know what accelerated these studies in microbiota? Like, was there anything particular that made it possible to grow faster?
So I think there was a lot of research going on in the last decade or 12, 15 years. Once you know that the gut microbiota has an influence in our health and disease, there are more and more interest, more and more people working on it. And on the other hand, there is also this omics that have been developed in the last decade as well. And you can study not only what is in our gut, it was done by this 16S sequencing, but now we can also know what are these bacteria doing? Where are the genes that are active in our bacterial community? So this was done through metagenomics. And then we are talking about metabolomics. What are these bacteria producing and what are these metabolites doing to us? So the development of all those omics have accelerated a lot as well, the study of the microbiome.
What is this 16S sequencing?
This 16S is common for all the bacteria. So you can target all the bacteria, but each of them are a bit different. So it's like an ID of the bacteria.
So this is how you can recognize them.
And you can recognize which kind of species are out there. There are limitations. Sometimes you cannot reach the species. You are a bit more up, so more high level, and you can reach, okay, this is the genus of the bacteria, but I don't know which species it is. That's why it develops to more fancy techniques with more deep sequencing to really know all the bugs we have in our bodies.
Anna, thank you very much for this real interesting conversation about the live biotherapeutic, the microbiota, microbiota's role actually in colorectal cancer. And guys, if you want to see where Recolony is now, please go to their website, recolony.ch, which is recolony.ch. Thanks very much, Anna.
Thank you.
I'm totally impressed by the audacity of researchers turned startup founders, doctors turned entrepreneurs, or ordinary parents turned healthcare innovators. People battling the battles that no one fought before for the extra health of the future. So if you see a startup posting on LinkedIn, show them some love, hit like, comment, that's fabulous. If you have a couple drops more of that altruism, follow the Exhale Show. Leave a review here. I'll be able to bring more of these visionaries to you. So a big thank you. You're awesome. See you next week.
The information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be considered medical advice. If you have any medical questions, please consult your healthcare practitioner. The opinions on the show are Alex's or her guests. The podcast does not make any responsibility or warranties about guest statements or credibility. While the podcast makes every effort to ensure that the information shared is accurate, please let us know if you have any comments, suggestions, or corrections.